Hello, this is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio. It's April 2nd, 2011. I'm coming to you from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And I'm on with co-host James Moffat in Toronto. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, Chris. How are you?
Okay. We're starting to get a little milder weather up here. Nice.
Yeah.
I'm longing to get out and work in the garden.
Yeah, same here. It finally has warmed up a little bit. It's been very cold and very uncomfortable. I'm a little sick of this, actually. Nice to have the sun out.
Yeah. So today we were going to pick up on our explorations of Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, which is a... We're going to be exploring this over a series of shows, trying to explain some of the enigmatic teachings in this book. So we're going to mainly devote today's show to further explorations of Beelzebub. And I think, Jim, it's usually useful for us to go back and explain a bit from the beginning so that new listeners kind of are hip a little bit to some of the backgrounds. Otherwise, it's a pretty, if you just jump into Beelzebub's tales, which is, for people unfamiliar with it, this is the classic work of G.I. Gurdjieff, and it's called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, and it was published in 1950, and Gurdjieff died in 1949, and it's in three parts, and it's Gurdjieff's attempt as a mystic to embody his teaching into this grand tale about this character Beelzebub. And Beelzebub, he originally lived in higher realms, but was banished to our solar system of Oris. And he took up residence on the planet Mars. And he visits the Earth at different times during its history. And what Beelzebub's Tales as a book is all about, well, at least in my understanding of it, I emphasize four areas that it explores. And today at times I'm going to be reading from Beelzebub's Tales and also be reading from my book called The Slugs, which is an attempt to explain the Beelzebub's Tales. And in my book, I emphasize that there are four areas of study that we focus on. The first concerns the general history and psychopathology of humankind on that ill-fated planet Earth. Gurdjieff provides a remarkable teaching of psychology and explains how the three brain beings on planet Earth acquired such strange psyches. He ties it into the history of the formation of the solar system, and he maintains that long ago a comet hit the Earth and it broke off the moon and another fragment. And these were ejected and had to settle into orbit. And when they settled into orbit, that caused another catastrophe on the Earth, which caused a submersion of the continent of Atlantis. So Gurdjieff's first visit to Earth was during the time of Atlantis, and then he visits Asia and the Middle East. He visits the Earth at different points through human history after the planet has changed and undergone different cosmic catastrophes. The first one having to do with the breaking off of the moon, and then the submersion of Atlantis. And then after that, there was a period of great winds, which covered over earlier civilizations and gave form to new land masses. So Beelzebub's Tales, it's an attempt. Gurdjieff in the opening says, he refers to providing an objective criticism of the life of man, like to try to see human beings from an alien or higher dimensional perspective and to look at humankind. And another of the main themes of Beelzebub's Tales is how those three-brained beings on planet Earth, they periodically engage in the processes of reciprocal destruction or warfare. So from Beelzebub's viewpoint, warfare is a phenomenally strange phenomena, and it's unknown elsewhere in the universe. So he's asking, what's the causes of war on planet Earth, that people periodically go out and engage in this these processes of reciprocal destruction and destroying other civilizations and peoples? So the third focus of Beelzebub's tales is on Gurdjieff's teaching about what he calls objective science. And he says, like, his objective science is something totally different than what we would consider in modern times to be objective science, which Gurdjieff or Beelzebub would call the science of new formation. And Gurdjieff's objective science deals with what he says are fundamental cosmic laws, the laws of three and seven. And these principles, the laws of three and seven, one can find them throughout different mystical literature, and they're elaborated in different ways. Like, they're the basis of the Kabbalistic tree of life embodies the law of three and seven. The three supernals in the realm above and the seven lower spheres in the tree of life. See, the tree of life embodies the principles of three and seven. And these laws, and Gurdjieff calls them the laws of Triamazikamno and Heftaparaparshanok. He gives them odd, peculiar names in his tales. So he, in Beelzebub's tales, is explaining these principles of what he calls objective science, and how these principles of the law of three and seven are involved in the creation of the cosmoses and of living beings. And he says that a completed human being comes to embody the megalocosmos, like to be a microcosm of the macrocosm. And partly how a human being is a microcosm of the macrocosm is that these laws of three and seven are within ourselves. And part of the riddle of self-realization is completing the inner triangle and accumulating the energies of all the levels, seven levels of the Heptaparaparshanok. So Gurdjieff is saying what we want to do is attain becoming a particle of all that exists. Okay, he says that in a way we're all a particle of all that exists, and these higher laws operate within ourselves. So Beelzebub's tales explores this theme of objective science. And lastly, Beelzebub's tales provides Gurdjieff's ideas concerning the psychology of the soul and the science of the soul. And he explains what to him that means. For Gurdjieff, a human being, we don't automatically have a soul. And we're not all guaranteed a place in heaven or paradise or hell. But instead, we have to attain our soul. And Gurdjieff provides a very subtle and complex teaching about what that means, which involves what he calls the crystallization of the higher being bodies, the Kesjan body and the highest being body, which would be more commonly known as the mental body. So Gurdjieff, in the tales, provides a whole model of how a human being doesn't just have a planetary body, but you have a Kesjan body related to the level of the sun and the planets, and you have a mental body related to the sun. So for Gurdjieff, we can acquire, through alchemical processes, we can accumulate in our being more of these energies and matters of the higher being bodies. And then you crystallize that higher being body for the life of the soul. So Gurdjieff provides a complex teaching about such concepts, which otherwise are hardly ever addressed, and certainly not addressed in the mainstream of modern psychology and science. So just to sum up as a quick brief introduction, there are four main areas that we're looking at. The psychopathology of man and how their psyche became so strange, the causes of war and why human beings can't stop war on the planet or have been unable to, the principles of objective science, and the science of the soul. And in Gurdjieff's book, it's these different teachings and stories are all intertwined in quite a hodgepodge. Jim, isn't Beelzebub's Tales quite a hodgepodge of teachings and ideas and a quite bizarre otherworldly book?
Yes. Yes, very peculiar book.
It's something we've worked at like for 30 years now. Not that we worked at it all the time. I mean, we studied it and read it, and then you're involved in other teachings and such. But, you know, we both struggled to understand it for over 30 years now.
Yeah, and I think everything that we do in terms of studying tends to give us more of a grasp of how to glean what he's actually saying, because everything is about studying more and more of what he calls the laws of world creation and world maintenance. And I would say that, like, our study of science and other mystical and esoteric teachings has that broad common theme, is that we're trying to understand different perspectives and how things can be understood. And I mean, and in that sense, I would say that that we're, like, over the years, we've become much more sophisticated in our capacity to approach the book. As I said before, when we were talking before about the on the program, it's hard in a way. Like, this book is so difficult in some ways to read, but in other ways it can be read if you're willing to put the effort into sort of getting through the very unusual rhythm of the author's voice and the writing, because it is peculiar. But then you get used to it somehow, and if you're willing to make that effort, the book is certainly rewarding and certainly fascinating. But as an introduction to Gurdjieff's teaching, it's very difficult, because I read it, and I think you did too, after we'd read many other books about Gurdjieff and the Fourth Way, which involves like straighter expositions of the ideas. So, and having said that, I think there are things in Beelzebub's Tales. There's a different emphasis to Beelzebub's Tales, which is quite distinct from other works about the Fourth Way, and even Gurdjieff's other presentations of the teaching. But it's more than a handful. It's very difficult to digest and has to be approached with an open mind and a deeply inquiring mind, because you can't grasp it. It's just so complex, and yet at the same time, I think there are little nuggets throughout it that you can grasp. And I think the humor of the book, it's a very funny book. It's an allegory, it's told in a certain stylized format, but it's also very funny, and by appropriating the voice of an extraterrestrial intelligence, which is essentially what Beelzebub represents, you get this distance from everything that we take to be our knowledge of and understanding of ourselves, and the effect of that, as you read through the book, is to really provide a much more objective perspective, which is in keeping with his aim of an objective, impartial criticism of human beings and the history of the planet Earth. And so from that perspective, it's so interesting how he's able to create this distance from not only big questions, but basic things like our words for various things. He creates all these neologisms to represent things that, like, common things like water and time very basic human concepts. But in creating these strange words and in repeating them, you have a sort of a it deconditions your reaction to language. Like, I think that's one of the main things that he's trying to do in telling the story in the way that he's doing it, is he doesn't want to put anything into any kind of familiar or easily grasped language. Like, he could do that because he's done it in other writings, but he really wants you to work to even understand water and time and other basic concepts. And by doing so, it creates this, you get this very strong sense of how we're conditioned by our language, and all of our associations to words are just automatic and don't really involve conscious intelligence. And I think that's a sort of tension that he's trying to create is part of the great appeal of the book, and it really distances you from everything human, which is the purpose of the book.
Yeah, it certainly gives you a very different view of the life of humankind, and it's almost in a way a tragic comedy.
That's good. Yes, it
like
is.
It mixes those two elements. Like, it's tragic because he's asking, why do these beings engage in these processes of reciprocal destruction and mass murder and rebellions, and how are all these this abnormality coming to be, and how tragic it is, and yet it's also comical. It's also absurd in a way, and he presents how absurd and tragic kind of people are at the same time.
It does.
I think one example of, like, I think one of the clearest examples for me of what you say about, like, having this extraterrestrial perspective is the reason for the Beelzebub 6 visit to planet Earth. And he's up there on Mars, and he has a telescope where he calls a Tescueno. And he's got this famous Tescueno, and it magnifies things 7,000,025 times. So he's observing the beings on planet Earth. And
I already know what you're going to say. Sorry.
You know the story.
Go ahead.
I said it before, but
It's so funny though. Every time you bring this up, I find it funnier and funnier every time you bring it up. Sorry. Go ahead.
And he's kind of observing on planet Earth, and he sees something he's never seen before, and that is that they've invented something new, whereby a being over here can do a little something here, and there's a little puff of smoke. And then another man over there falls down dead or disabled. And what he's depicting is like the invention of firearms. And yet it's kind of like seen from this other perspective, how absurd it is. A person over here can kind of, pull a little trigger, and the man over there falls down dead. And this is kind of like Beelzebub's views of, like, this example, if you look at modern weaponry, I mean, that's one of one example of what Gurdjieff calls Husnamussian science, which is science used by these kind of psychopaths who lack the capacity for divine conscience. And we'll talk about what he calls Husnamus individuals. But one of they have Husnamus sciences, and part of the Husnamus sciences are the invention of ever new methods for carrying out these processes of reciprocal self-destruction. And so in this example, Beelzebub, it's going back to the kind of beginning of the invention of firearms, and it represents something so simply like a firearm. Someone over here does a little something with the finger, and the man over there falls down dead. And how absurd it is, and how bizarre. And he gives you that foreign perspective, whereas we've come to accept it so much, all these kind of weapons of mass destruction that the nations of the world invest in and enrich the plutocrats and the bankers, and have all these wars based on lies. So people can make money and acquire power, and all these deviant things done in our world. And it's like humankind has gone insane. And that's kind of what Beelzebub's tales is saying, like humankind has gone insane. And Beelzebub's trying to understand the nature of that insanity and the causes of it. And as you say also, Jim, just the last comment, it's certainly a book, as I've reread it through my life, every time you reread it, it reveals more, and it becomes easier and easier to read because you become familiar with certain terminology, which initially is very difficult, but after a while, then it becomes habitual, and you know the reference to his words. So it is like learning a secret or an alternative language in a way. It grows on you. Like even last night, I've been working at a new chapter for the slugs. I've added over 50 pages to my newer version of this book, which I'm really, really pleased with. And I was just writing last day on a new chapter called The Degeneration of Religion. And every time I read the book and go over it, it's amazing things in there that I'd never seen before. And I'll give some examples of that today, some of the newest discoveries.
Very much what, as you say, it's encoded. So, and I think at one point he says everything has seven aspects and seven meanings in Beelzebub. But when you're talking, I mean, another reaction to the depiction of the invention that he sees is so funny, because in a way, like somebody might write a book, a human being might write a book about the history of firearms and, you know, the development of firearms, like the rifles and pistols and things, and they'd go into all sorts of detailed explanations about, you know, the rise of technology and to how these ideas, I don't know if anybody's actually written a book about that, I'm sure they have, but it's kind of like the way I see it is, and the way when you relate that story about he's looking through his Tescuano, and all of a sudden, I was going to say his telescope, and suddenly I fell into the right term. Somebody over here does a certain something, which is kind of one of Gurdjieff's little ways, of Beelzebub's ways of speaking, a certain something, and then there's a puff of smoke, and then somebody falls down over here. It's kind of like a stick drawing of the invention of weapons, and it's more powerful, and in a way, the absurdity is more powerful in that very simplistic rendering, rather than if you tried to go into a highly technical and convoluted explanation of the development of technology. You know, it's just like, why would anybody do that? It's like, yeah, I can kind of see him looking through the telescope and going, what? You know, what was that? And that's the reaction he's trying to create. Well, like, what was that when human beings arrived at this great moment in their evolution? You know, what was that? And everything that it spawned since then. I mean, that's what's so amazing, because then you start thinking, oh my God, you know, from that little acorn, you know, great oaks have grown, and now, you know, we have weapons of planetary destruction and awful things that threaten the existence of the planet. I wanted to say one thing is we were talking about hazonomous individuals, and like a lot of the terminology in Beelzebub, like some of the words, different words have, he wrote the book in, I think he wrote it in Armenian, and I think, and then it was translated, because he was working with a bunch of people, and they were translating it into Russian and English, I believe. I don't think he wrote it in Russian. I'm almost positive he wrote it in Armenian. And then it was translated into Russian and English and French. And he had quite a grasp of a lot of different languages. Like, he spoke Armenian and Russian and English and French and Turkish and knew other languages, too. And he used to take people describe how he would take parts of different languages and put them together to create terms. And sometimes he would just take things that he saw and incorporate that into names of things. So some things have meanings and some things don't. But like we were talking about hazonomous, and I suggested that like Hasnamus has no mass. He's talking about somebody who has no substance in a way. Like, I think that might be like an English derivation of that term. It's interesting too that when he talks, when Gurdjieff was translating things, he kept saying to people, "What does it make you feel?" That's what he wanted when he was deriving terms, is like, what does it make you feel? And when he was translating what he's trying to say. So he was always trying to appeal to deeper levels of feelings and emotions in his term. And you're going to talk about religion. I was looking at the book today and I realized he calls religions, the term that he has for religions is Havat Verononi, I don't even know how to pronounce it, but Havat Verononi. And I was thinking, like, well, one way you could kind of understand that term, because he talks about religions as being degenerations of teachings brought from messengers above to the planet Earth, and he talks about how Buddhism was, as introduced by Saint Buddha, became something quite different from what the Buddha had taught, and he talks about that in terms of other religions. But like, I just thought in terms of have at. So to have at something is to have a go at something. It's kind of like a frivolous, like spontaneous action at something with no great planning. So and then ver is like the root in Latin for veritas, is truth. In French, it's vérité. I'm sure in other languages, it's to have that truth, and then no is French for no, so the negation. So in a way, I think that Havat Verononi is his term for people's. He's trying to encompass the idea that people have somewhat frivolously and unthinkingly just had a go at the truth and negated it through their actions. I mean, that's, you know, it may be somewhat far-fetched, but that's kind of the thought I had about that term.
Well, I think that's really appropriate. I like that from what I've just been reading about in terms of his discussion of the degeneration of the, like, genuine teachings from sacred individuals, and how each of them afterwards, it's the learned beings who kind of gather together and they like have their chance at the truth, like they, you know, and they come up with their own versions of the and distortions of the genuine teachings, and Beelzebub is discussing how each religion became distorted in that way, and it gave rise to sects and then secular violence between the different, like, Shias and the Sunnis and the different Christians and the Christians and the Muslims and all these religions. It's like all these learned beings gathered kind of pieces of these genuine teachings, and then he describes them as pecking it to death. That they peck apart all these elements that they have, and they concoct their own kind of elaborations and misleading teachings. And that's partly how he explains the degeneration of religion. So it's very much, as you say, Jim, it's like they, it may be explained, have their turn at kind of answering the truth. Like, it's like everybody's own little version.
Well, you just said it. Like, that's another kind of way that the ver could be version. It could be truth. It could be version. You know, like everybody has a version. So have that there. Yeah, it's like
that really applies.
You just kind of spontaneously generated that. You know, I was like, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating how, like, as I say, you don't want to get too caught up in this, but it, like he does use these words that he's trying to tell you something with these terms at different times, and I think that's it. Like it's have at the truth and have at your own version of things, you know, and so both of those would apply, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. That's a very interesting insight into that word. I mean, that's what Beelzebub's Tales, it's like a mystery story and this profoundly enigmatic book. And as you read it, what seemingly at the beginning just seems ridiculous and obscure, and the more and more you study it, the deeper and deeper it gets, and it's an amazing book. Even to think the title of it is Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, and the purpose of the book, like the story, is that Beelzebub is traveling on a spaceship after he's left our solar system, after being here for many, many centuries. And he's traveling back within the larger universe. And he's explaining to his grandson, Hasin, he's giving him an education. And this education is explained in terms of his life experiences and the three-brained beings on planet Earth. So the storyline is that Beelzebub is educating his grandson. And yet what's kind of ironic about it is that, in a way, the reader is essentially Hasin. Like, we're being educated. We're receiving this kind of education for being provided by this being who's lived within our solar system for millennia and has an objective criticism of the life of humankind and the explanation of the cosmic laws.
And it also, like, Hasin, as you say, is like, it represents us in a way, and it represents us in the sense that he's a child and he's not at full maturation, so he doesn't really understand the nature of things. And at the same time, he represents what's open in us to hearing the truth. So there's a part of us that the seen part is the part of us that still remains open to hearing the truth. And then another thing is, like, in the title, as you say, is Beelzebub's Tale. So how does Beelzebub relate the history of humankind to his grandson? What is a child like? A child likes stories. So he tells him stories. He tells him some tales. And, you know, like, I mean, and within the whole esoteric tradition, there's the whole tradition of teaching stories, which are usually, like, quite simplistic on the surface tales about things, which have multiple meanings and can be understood very superficially and don't seem to have any great import, but are encoded and symbolize something much deeper. And in a sense, I think that refers to that's part of why he said called it Beelzebub's Tales also.
Yeah, and it's an amazing book, and it actually has that experience on one as one reads it and over time begins to penetrate its depth. In a way, it helps cultivate or grow something within oneself. Last time we talked a little bit about Beelzebub's first visits to the planet Earth, and we gave some of the background of the cosmic catastrophes and his story about how there was an organ implanted in humankind called the Kunda buffer. It's like the word Kundalini instead of Lini, it's buffer. And a buffer for Gurdjieff is something like, if you have two train cars, the buffers, it prevent the impact of different cars upon each other, something that serves to cushion the blows. So a Kunda buffer, it sounds like it blocks off this Kundalini life energy. So man is kind of blocked off from his essential consciousness. I think that's the basic concept of the Kunda buffer. And now this organ is implanted in man for a certain period of time by a higher commission. And it was partly to stabilize the moons, but I won't go into all that detail at the moment. It was then removed. Now, the two main effects of the Kunda buffer were described by Beelzebub as causing human beings to perceive reality topsy-turvy, that we perceive reality upside down. We don't perceive the reality of existence, but we form a false consciousness system. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, how we form a dual consciousness system. And what should be our true consciousness passes into what Gurdjieff calls the subconsciousness. And instead, there's the formation of this false egoism. Okay, in a way, the Kunda buffer, what it did is it crystallized in human beings their false ego. Beelzebub compares the effects of the organ Kunda buffer to the drug cocaine, which gives people like an inflated sense of self and self-importance and hedonistic, kind of impulsive existent being. So it's like cocaine on people, and this gives this leads to this kind of formation of this false egoism in people, and this usurps the true consciousness, which kind of then passes into the subconscious. And this whole teaching is in the Uspenskian version of the Gurdjieff teaching. This is the difference between what you would call essence and false personality. And for Gurdjieff, he says, when a child is born, like they're simply in their essence, they, in a sense, are what they are. And over time, what happens is they're conditioned by the external reality. So their caretakers and the media and the education and all these different cultural and social influences, which add contents to and impress information and experiences upon a person's basic being centers. Okay, so for instance, like in your essence, a human being has a heart center and has a capacity for different emotions. Okay, but then how, as an adult, what is in the person's emotional life going to be? One person might grow up in a family where they're put down and demeaned a lot and discouraged, and they're depression and anxiety, and that person has been conditioned in a certain way by their life experience. Now, in their essence, that isn't what that person is. Okay, it's because they're out of touch with what's in their essence that they experience those states. So what happens is, as people become conditioned, they form false personality, like acquired characteristics, which are artificial. Like for Gurdjieff, he would explain that most negative emotions are unnecessary. They're artificial creations. They only have existence because we kind of believe in them and give them energy. But there's a falsity to the whole thing. So partly then, the main theme of Beelzebub's tales is explaining the psychopathology of humankind in terms of the formation of a dual consciousness system, where the essential consciousness has passed into the subconscious, and basic to this essential consciousness is, for Beelzebub, four divine or sacred being impulses. And these include faith, hope, and love, the three virtues of Christian Judaic teachings, faith, hope, and love. And the fourth is of divine conscience. So Beelzebub explains that these higher being, they're sacred emotions or sacred being impulses. And these, if a person is awakened in themselves and attains a certain awareness of the totality of self, then that awakens faith, hope, and love, the capacities for those sacred experiences within the person. And then the remorse, objective conscience, or the remorse of conscience, is a fourth sacred being impulse. But what Beelzebub is explaining, that because of education and socialization and such, these sacred being impulses pass into the subconscious. And instead, people form their emotional investments are in all these fanciful, non-existent or important things that they give their attention to, all the trivia. Like he would talk, for instance, love people's fascination with fashion, and the attempt to conceal what one really is, as Gurdjieff would talk about it. The fascination with fashion or the arts or drama, all artificially created. For Gurdjieff, another thing is sports. He talks about the English inventing sports and keeping people titillated and involved in the sports. All these cultural inventions, which Beelzebub regards as feeding this false egoism, or a consequence of this false egoism in human beings. So this is the most important theme, is the formation of this dual consciousness system. Jim, maybe you want to comment on that. And just, we see how his language in Beelzebub, how it relates to Uspensky's distinction, between essence and personality or false personality. And it's the same how in Beelzebub, it's how our true consciousness passes into the subconscious.
Yeah, because he explains it in a very different way in Beelzebub, and he has mythological explanation of what's happened. But what he's really like, when you're saying about buffers too, like buffers also, he in the Uspensky inversion referred to how people have different cells and how they different eyes within themselves, how they lead quite distinct different lives and have all these contradictions within themselves, but don't experience them because of buffers. And at one point he says that if buffers were removed, people would go mad because they would see that how inconsistent and how contradictory their entire existence is if it's taken as an entirety rather than as these separate isolated cells. So he says that's the main, it's based because people identify and they emotionally invest themselves in these different eyes, and that the process of identification keeps these different eyes alive and also separate from one another, so that people can't experience themselves as a whole and have these separate cells instead within themselves. And that's the main impediment to the development of conscience, because people are caught up and identified in these lower cells and don't experience themselves as a whole. And so in the Beelzebub's tales, you have the tale of the moon splitting off from the earth, and then this other body, like that could be seen as representing the different brains in people. Like Gurdjieff talks about the three brain beings, and that these, what was once one, becomes three separate distinct entities, and that they're not connected, even though they continue to influence one another, but in ways that aren't understood. And I think that, like, that sort of represents the existence of the three separate brains within ourselves, which are also separated by these buffers.
Wow, that's really insightful, Jim. That's such a neat view of discussing that. Like,
well, I can't take credit for that, because I think that actually, I think in A.R. Oraj's commentaries on Beelzebub, I think that's where I read that. I know I didn't think of that myself, but I think that is a good representation of what he's talking about when he's talking about the splitting off, you know. And
yeah,
as I say, so many things in the book have these different aspects and have these different meanings, you know. Like they can be taken on the cosmological. That's a very good example, actually. Like there's something, like he's talking about a cosmological phenomena that happened to the planet Earth, but at the same time he's saying that the same thing happens on the level of the psychological. It's very clever how, like, so that's an example of how the macrocosm and the microcosm are related, and he's symbolizing that in this splitting off of the moon and the other unknown moon that split off. And I think many things in the book are like that. When he's talking on one level, you have to remember that nothing really just exists on that one level, that there's all these different levels that things can be applied.
I think just staying with that, like how the moon splitting off, it reminds me, like, how in yogic philosophy, for instance, the self within the heart is associated with the sun, and said to be the center of the solar system and the abode of the self-illuminating Jiva Atma, the divine or the spiritual spark related to the heart, and the heart is the sun of the body. But then the yogis compare the mind in the head, they compare that to the moon, because the moon has no light of its own, it only reflects the light of the sun. Just like the yogis say, the mind, the consciousness in the head and the mind in the head only reflects this consciousness, which really originates out of the heart. So it's the light of the self within the heart which can illuminate the mind. And the mind in the head is associated with the realm of the moon. So I think this, that drawing of that analogy is really appropriate. And we see in Beelzebub's tales, and in Gurdjieff's teaching more broadly, that he says the center of functioning or coordination for the false self system or the egoism is the thinking brain within the head. Whereas Beelzebub explains that the deepest emotional center is related to the heart and the complex of nerves of the autonomic nervous system, which we'll come to in a minute. So in a way, the egoic self is centered in the mind, in the head, whereas the deeper self is related to the essence and related to the heart and the original emotional center in the heart. And here, Jim, I might... First, I just wanted to read one of Gurdjieff's passages explaining this kind of duality of consciousness. And it's neat to read Gurdjieff because his language is so distinctive and unusual. But here's a sample. "But as for the sacred data for genuine being consciousness put into them by great nature, which consciousness ought to be possessed by them from the very beginning of their preparation for a responsible existence, together with the properties inherent in them, which engender in them the divine, the genuine sacred being impulses of faith, hope, love, and conscience. These data become gradually also isolated, and being left to themselves, evolve independently of the intentions of the responsible beings, and of course also independently of the bearers of them themselves, and come to be regarded as what is called the subconsciousness." And then he says at another point, he says, "With such an already quite automated consciousness." See, one of the, Beelzebub explains that the influence of education on people, which he describes essentially as learning by rote or learning parrot-like, which is like acquiring information which is kind of stored in the mind and kind of learning all this information, which for Beelzebub, it has no connection to immediacy of one's own sensation and experience. So it's a kind of accumulating all this knowledge in the mind for which there's no comparable development of a person in their being. So he's talking about how we become conditioned mentally, emotionally, and physically, and we form an automated consciousness system. And he said, and completely nonsensical feelings. Okay, see, from Beelzebub's perspective, many human feelings are like nonsensical feelings, like they're not about anything real. They're this whole kind of culture of false personality and superficiality. So many of our feelings are nonsensical feelings. And you want to see nonsensical feelings, turn on your TV and watch a couple hours of kind of all the nonsensical dramas and titillation and such that one finds. and they feel themselves to be immeasurably superior to what they really are. And he's describing this as part of the egoism that forms in men. See, Beelzebub explains that the main thing that forms in man is this false egoism. But then there are all these, what he describes as secondary characteristics, which derive from these false egoism. And he's often listing some of these. For example, on one occasion, he says, these being impulses he describes as existing under the names of cunning, envy, hate, hypocrisy, contempt, haughtiness, servility, slyness, ambition, double-facedness, and so on and so on. So it's not just that man forms this false egoism, but as a further consequence of that, he develops all these egoistic negative emotional states and you know, Gurdjieff says that human beings hardly ever have relationships on equal basis. Either you kind of think you're superior to someone else and you look down on them and treat them like a slave, or else you assume the servility posture. Just as an example, and he talks about the cunning, like more and more I'm finding this word cunning is most useful. When I look at what has happened on the world situation and all these kind of secret societies, you know, and what how they have so cunningly brought about their new world order and all the things they're striving for, like a world currency, how cunning it's all been. Like, that's what these people are, these psychopaths who run our society. They're so cunning, eh? Like 9/11, they were so cunning. You know, they led us to believe it was Muslim terrorists. And it was so cunning of them to do that. I think this word of cunning is profoundly valuable to look at the kind of deviousness of what goes on politically. So for Beelzebub, he's explaining not only do human beings have this kind of false egoism crystallized in them, but then they have all these kind of other abnormal being impulses that's just not natural for people to have. Servility, haughtiness, contempt, hate, hypocrisy, and so on. He doesn't view our emotional life as very evolved, does he, Joe?
No. No. And it's funny because when he's listing these terms and he puts them in quotes, you know, you have to read it to really appreciate the effect it has on you. But it's very funny, and at the same time it's very moving, because you realize like how many different names there are for all the rotten emotional states that people enjoy and pursue and embrace and celebrate and he's very good in that way in showing the sort of the degenerated psyche of the three brain beings of the planet Earth. You know, when you were talking earlier about, we were talking about the splitting off of the moon, I just realized it's kind of in a way, I wonder if the moon realizes that it doesn't shine with its own light. Does the moon realize that it reflects the light of the sun? You know, it's kind of that's us, eh? We think that consciousness is generated in the head brain, but, you know, the idea that consciousness is generated and the life impulse is generated in the heart, and that the head brain is akin to the moon is very interesting. It's a very interesting metaphor, but it's also, it's also, you know, a very interesting reality to contemplate, and I'm realizing how this whole story it relates on the cosmic level that he's talking about, and how the moon that we don't recognize could be likened to the spinal cord and the moving instinctual brain in the fourth way teaching. It's kind of subservient and is obscured by the head brain, because we think everything is generated in the head brain, but really, you know, we have these three brains that interact, and how we don't sort of recognize the importance of this third brain. In the whole impetus kind of modern science is to focus everything on, in terms of explaining consciousness and experiences is trying to explain it in terms of the head, brain, like the one brain. It's very interesting, just, you know, sort of reflecting on how this relates to everything we've been talking about for the last 5 years on this program.
Yeah. Yeah, here's a quote from Beelzebub, and Jim and I use the word three-brained being, which is used throughout Beelzebub's tales to refer to human beings on planet Earth. And Beelzebub says, they, like every other three-brained being of the whole of our great universe, has three separately independent spiritualized parts, each of which has as a central place for the concentration of all its functioning, a localization of its own, which they themselves call a brain. Okay, and then Beelzebub explains that, like, he labels these as thinking center, feeling center, and moving motor center. Or sometimes he refers to the moving motor as the moving instinctual center. So the basic concept is that a human being functions mentally, emotionally, and physically, which is very, like, intuitively correct, kind of. Like, it's funny how in modern psychology has always been dualistic. They've thought of human beings as having a mind and a body, and it's a dualistic model, whereas Gurdjieff says, no, there's a mind, then there's the emotional center, which is a completely separate aspect of mind and intelligence and of being within the person. It's not, see, in modern thought, they all think that emotions are kind of secondary to the mind. It's like the intellectuals think about the mind, and they think that it's the autocratic leader in the affair. But really, the emotional center is a whole separate brain and part of our being. So a human being, we're three-brained. We're not simply one-brained being, as is believed in modern science. Like, they believe you have one brain in the head, and it's connected to the body. And Gurdjieff's saying that's completely wrong. You have three spiritualized parts. And then he explains that the head brain is the basis for the thinking center. And then he talks about the basis for the emotional or feeling center. And he tells in the tales an interesting story explaining to Beelzebub that in the beginning, these three-brained beings of the planet Earth had this concentration, the emotional center, similar to us, in the form of an independent brain localized in the region of their what is called breast. Now, here, Gurdjieff doesn't say it's within the heart. He says there's an independent brain localized in the region of their what is called breast. But in the region of your breast is your heart. So I would say that he's saying here that in Beelzebub and his kinsmen, that this independent brain is the heart. Okay. From the time when the process of their ordinary being existence began particularly sharply to change for the worse, then nature was compelled, without destroying the functioning itself of this brain of theirs, to change the system of its localization. That is to say, she gradually dispersed the localization of this organ, which had its concentration in one place in them, into small locations over the whole of their common presence, but chiefly in the region of what is called the pit of the stomach. The totality of these separate localizations in this region, they themselves at the present time call the solar plexus, or the complex of nodes of the sympathetic nervous system. Now, this is very profound, what Gurdjieff is saying here, and it's very relevant to modern psychology. Because In modern psychology, it's been assumed that the basis for emotional life is really in the limbic area of the brain, under the cortex, but and above the kind of brain stem. And in the limbic, where you have the amygdala body and the fornix and different subcortical areas of the brain, and they think that's kind of the center for emotional experience. But what Beelzebub is saying is no, the emotional brain is actually the autonomic nervous system. Now, in the human being, the autonomic nervous system is completely outside of the skull and of the spinal cord. It's like a secondary nervous system within the human being, is the autonomic nervous system. Now, it connects into the central nervous system in the brain, but its main tracks and fibers are all outside of what's called the central nervous system, which is enclosed in the brain, under the skull, and in the spinal cord. So the autonomic nervous system is like a second nervous system within the human being. So we don't just have one nervous system. In a way, we have different nervous systems within the same being. And if you actually look at I'm skipping ahead of myself. So what Beelzebub is saying here, he's saying that originally the three-brained beings, their emotional center was connected to the heart. But then what happens is it's dispersed from the heart into the complex of nerve nodes of the autonomic nervous system. Now, the main place that people feel anxiety and tension, one of the main places is the solar system, which is just under your diaphragm.
Solar plexus.
Sorry, solar system, did I say? Yeah, solar plexus.
Interesting slip.
Okay, you also, and so that's a major place where people feel anxiety, tension. Yeah. It's the solar plexus. Or if you feel very relaxed, you can feel a warmth in the solar plexus. So it's I would say, a chief site for the localization of egoic emotional states. Okay, so, and then he's saying it's not only the solar plexus, but also other plexi of the autonomic nervous system. For instance, in the autonomic nervous system, you have the hypogastric plexus. Okay, so that's related to the rectum and lower intestine. That's why if people are very afraid, they will urinate or defecate because they lose control of the hypogastric plexus. Okay, also your tear glands in your head. Those are part of the autonomic nervous system. You don't see, tears are not voluntarily controlled by the central nervous system. Instead, tears, unless you're an actor and you've learned to feign this, and that can certainly be done, but tears are ordinarily produced when things make us feel a certain way. So it's like an autonomic function rather than a conscious intentional. You don't make a decision. I think I'm going to cry now, even though a person might seemingly do that and then they let them down and they cry. But rather, crying is something that happens, and the autonomic responsibility or reactivity is how events make us feel. So it's like an autonomic function. So Gurdjieff's idea that the autonomic nervous center is a center for emotional reactivity is very interesting from a scientific and psychological viewpoint. Hey, Jim, like, did you ever encounter any concepts like that in your studies of modern psychology?
No. Well, no. In general, no. I mean, I think some people, with some knowledge of esotericism, sort of question the the idea that everything is dominated and everything should be attributed to the processes of the brain. But as I said earlier, everything in modern studies of consciousness and awareness emphasizes the brain as the master organ, and really I think to great detriment to understanding of things, people have become like these disembodied brains, and there's almost no recognition in modern psychology that people have a physical body. It's like they've split off the study of the psyche from the body, and I think that's a huge error. I think that's like just, you know, really wrong, and I think that this perspective is much more meaningful, and I think it recognizes the complexity of the human organism, and like for instance, there are my understanding. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I have read that there are actually more neurons in the gastric plexus than there are in your brain.
Yeah, I've heard that as well.
And as you say, we have in the solar plexus these feelings related to these plexes, these nerve plexes, and we experience our emotions most directly in our bodies, and we don't experience them in our heads. And obviously, no. The limbic system is important in emotions, anybody who suffers one of the most common things that happens when a person suffers an acquired brain injury or a traumatic brain injury is that there is significant emotional pathology associated with that. So obviously there's an interaction with the brain, like the limbic system is important. But to suggest that all emotional processes are governed and experienced in your limbic system is completely wrong, I would say. And I think the picture is much, much more complicated. And this presents, a much more appealing model of what's actually going on. I think it's very, very important to recognize, like, that. I think this idea of the idea that we're three brain beings, I think, is so important.
Yeah, we could see like the limbic system could be the place where there's the interaction between the emotional center and the intellectual center.
Well, like I think that's exactly what is happening. You know, it's not like that. The limbic center isn't responsible, isn't implicated in emotional processes, because obviously it is to a certain extent. But to just think that everything, the idea that's wrong, I think, in the sort of conventional wisdom is that everything's sort of governed from the top down. Everything's, you know, everything's subordinate to what happens in the brain, and I just don't think that's in any way is correct. Interestingly enough, today, just on this topic, I heard something today on Quirks and Quarks, the CBC Science program, and they're talking about preventing Alzheimer's, and it turns out that the studies now being done show that one of the main ways of preventing the onset of Alzheimer's is for people as they age to engage in cardiovascular exercise, and moderate levels, and you know, they're trying to hypothesize what's going on there. And one of the ideas is that you're just increasing blood flow to the brain, you know, something very simple but very basic, which sort of, you know, shows that the integrity of the physical organism is really essentially implicated in understanding the nature of conscious experience, and that the brain is in many ways is subservient to the body. Like, it's not just that the brain directs everything in the body, but that these systems interact, and that the integrity of the entire physical organism is important in everything we experience in terms of both mental, physical, and emotional health.
And then, I mean, you look at the studies I present in the Heart Doctrine book, and you look at the research of the Heart Math Institute and Paul Pearsall, who explains that the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 10,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of the brain in the head. So clearly, from a physics point of view, If a human being, the center of a human being is not the mind in the head, but it's the emotional energies and field and life of the heart. And the heart forms well before the brain and the mind in the developing uterus, in a developing infant, in the womb. So the heart, from a physics science point of view, a human being is a quantum system, and the center of that human being's electromagnetic dynamics would be the heart, in rather than the mind in the head. And so clearly, I think, from a scientific viewpoint, the head would have to be regarded as secondary to the life and consciousness within the heart. And that is as Gurdjieff would explain it.
Yeah, I think it's 5,000 times, isn't it?
Yeah, 5,000. What did I say, 10,000?
You said 10, but I think it's 5.
Yeah, it's 5,000, yeah.
But I find that, like, that's such an interesting, you know, such a basic, interesting fact, eh? Wait a minute now. So if we were looking at a machine, as people tend to look at human beings, we're looking at a machine, and we were trying to understand, you know, what the power source was for the machine, and the volume, the electromagnetic volume, we were taking measurements and whatever type of measurements, and we found out that this area here is 5,000 times stronger than this area here. Wouldn't we sort of suspect that perhaps this is what's running the machine? That this is the source of its energy and its vitality? I mean, it's very peculiar how that is not recognized and how little recognition is afforded that. It's like when Kenneth Walker, who was quite an eminent British surgeon, studied with Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and he first heard the idea of the idea that human beings should be treated as three-brain beings. He said he was quite taken by this because he, as a surgeon, he had always observed and been amazed by the intelligence of the body, which he said exists in and of itself and is not, you know, subservient or not subordinate to brain processes. And he describes specific examples of doing surgery and cutting nerves that lead to the brain, and he talks about how the body's when he did the surgery, and he does sort of a very poor job of repairing things, and then he examines it 6 months or a year later. He says nature, the body itself, has done a magnificent job of improving on his very crude surgery. And he said, and he describes his process, and he says, you know, if you cut the nerves that connect with this part of the body, he's talking about, I think it was the urethra that he was talking about, the surgical process. He said, if you cut the nerves that connect the brain to the urethra, it's still it will still heal. It's not being directed by the brain. So he said, when I heard this idea, I was immediately taken by it. He said, many people seem to have a very difficult time believing this, but he said, I was immediately impressed by this because he said, that's what my experience as a surgeon had taught me, is that the brain is the brain, and that the physical body has its own intelligence, which is quite independent of the brain, although obviously connected and integrated with the brain. But, you know, I thought that was very interesting coming from a surgeon that he would have that reaction.
Yeah, it's over time. I think the way I view it now is that those scientists who investigated consciousness attempted to do so using their mind and their thinking and their analysis. And they're using the brain to try to investigate consciousness in a way centers their consciousness more within their mind, and then they assume that their brain and their thinking in their head is like the essential nature of consciousness. So I think the head doctrine came about as people approached the subjects of consciousness with the mind. And you can see in the consciousness literature how intellectually confabulated and distorted, like the babble in a way, in the literature on the subjects of consciousness when you go into it.
I think that's exactly right. And I think if you place the modern discussions of consciousness side by side with the ancient esoteric teachings about consciousness, and you really examine these ideas carefully, I don't see how anybody can believe the modern fairy tales. And as you say, that's what I see. I think the biggest effect that studying esotericism had on me was that I realized that these people actually knew what they were talking about. There's a an air of authority to like Gurdjieff's speeches and to other masters' teachings, which I just don't see. And when I in modern thinkers' discussions of consciousness, and what you say is true, I think, is that mainly it's just intellectual confabulation, and it's not rooted in anything. And it goes back to what you were talking earlier about the difference between the line of knowledge and the line of being, and this is quintessentially, I think, modern psychological discussions of consciousness are all just up in the head and have nothing to do and are not based on any kind of experiential verification of things and are divorced from the line of being. And I don't think these people have being. I was reading Susan Blackmore, a little excerpt from her little book that she's brought out on consciousness, that she's quoting Dennett and on consciousness and saying that the idea of consciousness is a delusion. I often think when I'm reading these materials that from conventional modern psychological thinkers, I often think of the Woody Allen joke where he said that he had been married to a philosophy major and that she proved to him that he didn't exist, you know. And I think that's kind of like, that kind of captures the sort of word games that people play in terms of trying to explain consciousness, and it's all up in their heads, and it's just completely ridiculous. Like, it has nothing to do with anything and really misses the whole essence of everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly, in a way, where we were 40 years ago when we began to try to understand what human consciousness was, and we were both involved in graduate studies in psychology, and we kind of explored the Western views of consciousness. But then we came across a Gurdjieff teaching, and what was so distinctively different in the Gurdjieff teaching, he says you have to understand consciousness within yourself. You have to study it by trying to remember to be aware of it and experience what it is within you. And if you begin to do that, then I think it's clearly self-evident through self-study and direct inner experience that consciousness is not simply centered in the head. That's not how human beings experience themselves at all. And the language disproves it, and many other things disprove the idea that our awareness of our own self-existence is all up in our head. It's simply not the case. But modern science has assumed, well, the head is the top authority on the top, kind of, and it integrates everything and synthesizes everything and produces consciousness, which they think is centered up in the head. And there's no reason to assume that at all. And in mystical teachings, no, consciousness can be distributed all through the body. And it's not produced by neurological activities. It's connected to the blood and the circulation of the vital energies in the subtle bodies. So I think what over time, the more and more I understood like consciousness through inner self-experience, I realized how ridiculous the head doctrine was. And even for me, something as simple as the experiment, I often get people in converse or lectures, I'll get people to put their hands together and see how they're usually about the same size in people. And then take your hands apart and put all your consciousness into your hand. Just being aware inwardly in your hand. And if you do that for a few moments, what happens, you put your hands back together and you'll find the hand you put your consciousness in actually enlargens, it's filled with more blood, and your hand actually grows in size relative to the hand that you weren't putting your awareness into. Now, what this suggests is that consciousness within us is actually related to blood flow. And this is such an alternative kind of model. So it's saying it's related to blood flow, but It's also saying that there's subtle soul energies and the kind of consciousness that's connected to the blood, that the blood isn't simply a physical thing, but it also carries these kind of consciousness and life and soul energies. So it's all connected to the blood. So we are ensouled through the heart and blood. And that's how consciousness somehow is connected to that ensoulment through the heart and the blood. And it's not simply a product of neurological processes up in the cerebral cortex. And you look at the history of science. I mean, I remember back in 1980, Carl Sagan's quote said in Cosmos, the cerebral cortex is where consciousness is manufactured out of matter.
Yeah.
And he kind of puts this quote in as though, oh, scientists know the cerebral cortex produces consciousness, and everybody accepts that. But that, in his own writing, Sagan provides absolutely no documentation or verification or argument. He just declares that, solving the ultimate mystery of the universe in the hop, a skip, and a jump. And he says, oh, the cerebral cortex produces consciousness. But he really has no understanding of what consciousness is and no credible theory about how it's produced by the cerebral cortex or any other part of the brain. It's a complete enigma in science. So it's much more useful to us to have a broader view of the potential nature of consciousness and not realize that this is a dogma, the dogma of the brain producing consciousness. And this has been the central dogma for the last century of modern science. And it all ties into the denial of soul and spirit in the life of humankind.
Yeah, it's odd, too, because at the same time, as I remember reading in 1979, the Scientific American had an entire issue devoted to the brain, and in one of the articles, somebody basically said in the article, well, when you get right down to it, really don't even understand how one neuron works, you know, like, I mean, we have a basic understanding, but we really don't understand anything fundamentally about the brain, and yet Carl Sagan was saying a year later in Cosmos that, oh, you know, brains where the cerebral cortex produces consciousness, and it's like you say, there's no evidence for that. It's just it's an assumption. It might even be true, but it's not. It's become dogmatically unquestioned and promulgated. And there's actually the evidence, I think, that to counter that idea is overwhelming. When you add it all up, I think it completely demolishes that assumption. But yeah, it's funny too when you were talking about the idea about studying consciousness within yourself, and when we began studying the fourth way, and one of the fundamental ideas in the Gurdjieff teaching about consciousness is that our normal waking consciousness is not a proper consciousness, but should be understood as a waking sleep, and that you have to study yourself to understand that. And it's funny, like, we were both graduate students in psychology, and nobody had ever suggested that to us. And then we started to study ourselves, and that's exactly what we found, is that, yes, our normal waking consciousness should be understood to be a waking sleep, and that once you understand that, you realize that people basically do see reality topsy-turvy. It's upside down, and we take everything mistakenly because we believe that we're properly conscious. It's like it's such an incredible discovery to realize that. And then the other thing is that from an esoteric and a mystical perspective, this whole idea that somehow human beings are these isolated little islands of consciousness in a world which is consists of dumb, non-sentient matter, which is adhering to nature's laws, you know, is completely ridiculous. And I think that's one of the things that Beelzebub transmits so well, is how human beings, even these strange three-brained beings of the planet Earth, are in interaction with the cosmos, and there's all sorts of different levels in which energies are being exchanged, and the planet is serving cosmic purposes, and there are higher intelligences descending to Earth to inform human beings, and there's all sorts of interaction between human beings and the cosmos, and the cosmos is not this big dumb machine that's running down through an entropic process, but it's alive, it's intelligent, it's animate, it's multi-layered, it's hierarchically structured, and it just defies the whole modern conception of the mechanical material nature of reality and how mechanical and material explanations are going to provide us with an understanding of everything. It just makes a mockery of all that, and I think that's the invaluable contribution of esotericism, is that materialism as a philosophical position to explain psychology or cosmology, I think, is a dead end. It's very useful to adopt that perspective to explain things in a limited sense, but in terms of providing a comprehensive and insightful understanding of what's really going on, I think it's hopeless. Like, it's just wrong, and it's wrong.
Yeah. So interesting. So throughout the Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff discusses what he calls the, like, learned beings, and he uses the term in a derogatory way, like, and he traces it back to these kind of learned beings from Greece who began inventing sciences, is how he said. From then on, the craze for, quote, cooking up these sciences passed from generation to generation. And so he had what he calls the scientists of new formation, or scientists of new format, or he refers to the sorry learned beings. So he has this view that, like, modern science got off track very early on, and that there were certain husnamasses, like certain individuals who kind of came up with their own theories which misled people and led people astray, and which led to the distortion of religious teachings. So you have this whole, in the Gurdjieff view, this kind of quack science. And that's, he says, these learned, like, learned beings. Here's what Beelzebub says: a learned being was considered wise in older times. A learned being, through their own conscious labors and intentional suffering, has acquired the ability, quote, to contemplate the details of all that exists from the point of view of world arising and world existence, owing chiefly to which they perfect their higher being bodies to the corresponding gradation of the sacred measure of objective reason, in that they might later sense as much about cosmic truths as their higher being body is perfected. So this is the ancient idea that someone who is truly wise has kind of developed their higher being bodies and obtained a level of objective reason. And in Beelzebub's tales, Beelzebub talks about different levels of higher gradients of reason that a person can attain. And then he compares that to what would be among contemporary men being. Those beings are considered wise who, quote, chiefly become learned, who learned by rote as much as possible about every kind of vacuous information, such as old women love to relate about what was presumably said in olden times. The more of such information one of your favorites mechanically learns by rote, information he himself has never verified, and which, moreover, he has never sensed, the more learned he is considered to be. Hey, and isn't that just like what modern education was about, hey, Jim, university?
Yeah.
It's like you have to kind of learn all these theories and arguments and ideas, and you kind of got to learn all this material by rote. And I remember sometimes people saying, like, 5 years after a course, like, they had no memory of anything they took in different courses. Like, it didn't even last, you know. You just had to learn it by rote for your exam, and then if you could, you were a good, could repeat things parrot-like well, and repeat what you were told and show that you had memorized it, then you got good marks. But really, it's just this information which a person hasn't transubstantiated in their own being through direct life experiences. And that's what Beelzebub's point is about the artificiality of modern education. It's all this learning by rote, but it's an education which doesn't, that people need to attain knowledge through the synthesis of knowledge and direct experience of phenomena. And here's, so Beelzebub, when he comes back for his sixth visit to the planet Earth, and this is after his fifth visit was at the time of Babylon, but it's millennia before Beelzebub returns to for his sixth and final visit to the Earth. And he's saying when he comes back, the modern civilization, he says, has mainly been influenced by the Greeks and the Romans. And he describes the first Greeks. He says they were like fishermen from Asia who used to travel, and they got isolated and they started camping on the shores of Greece. And they had nothing to do. They were bored. And so they began playing games, he said. And I'll read a bit of his description of this. Well, briefly, these bored fishermen played at first the ordinary children's games already established there long before. But afterwards, when one of them invented a new game called Pouring from the Empty into the Void, they were all so pleased with it that thereafter they amused themselves with that alone. This game consisted of formulating some question, always about some fiddle-faddle or other, that is to say, a question about some deliberate piece of absurdity, and the one to whom the question was addressed had to give as plausible an answer as possible. And it was just this same game that became the cause of all that happened later. It turned out that among those ancient bored fishermen, there were several so bright and ingenious that they became expert at inventing, and according to the principle of that peculiar game, very long explanations. And when one of them discovered how to make what is called parchment from the skins of the fish called shark, then some of the skillful fellows, just to swagger before their companions, even began inscribing these long explanations of theirs on these fish skins. Still a little later, when these bored fishermen had already given place to their descendants, both these inscribed fish skin and the craze for the said peculiar game passed on to the latter by inheritance, and these various new inventions, both their own and their ancestors, they called first by the very high-sounding name science. And from then on, as the craze for, quote, cooking up these sciences passed from generation to generation, the beings of that group, whose ancestors had been simple Asiatic fishermen, became specialists in inventing all kinds of sciences such as these. So that was how Beelzebub, he talks about the Greeks and the Romans as being major influences in modern civilization, and the Greeks invented sciences and cooking up all these different areas of science and trying to provide these best possible explanations, and then developing like fish parchments, and then he says later how this science, this tendency to cook up these sciences, it passes to Germany, and the Germans become the best expert in cooking up their sciences, and also then to England, and so. But all through his tales, he's talking about the kind of cooked up sciences of these sorry learned beings of modern times.
Yeah, one of the things that the term he uses all the time, one of the peculiar propensities of the three brain beings of the planet Earth is to wiseacre, which is to talk about things they don't know about. And he talks about that with regard to religion and how religions get distorted, and about science and about people's explanations of everything. And I would say that once you begin to study an esoteric teaching and the nature of consciousness, that's exactly what you see. You see how people wiseacre all the time about this, that, and everything. And from, you know, the most mundane level of things, where people have explanations for everything or have attitudes, opinions, and beliefs about everything, to like people like Carl Sagan and lofty tomes on, you know, much more sophisticated versions of parchment talking about how consciousness is produced in the cerebral cortex. You know, you just realize how empty so much of what passes for knowledge is, and it's just really the repetition of an elaboration of different types of levels of lying and people talking about things that they really don't understand or know.
Yeah, it's a very interesting how Gurdjieff uses that term, wiseacring. I wasn't really familiar with that before reading his book, and I didn't realize that really is a word. And one who pretends to, wiseacre is defined in the Oxford English Dictionary as, quote, one who thinks himself or wishes to be thought wise, a foolish person with an air of wisdom. And I thought, wow, what a perfect definition for what Gurdjieff means by when he talks about the modern wiseacres. It's like they're pretending to be wise, and you see that in so much academic scholarly studies. It's wiseacring. It's all these kind of, I just read a book. Where is this book? Called Consciousness Explained Better.
Oh yes, yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Well, I gave it to you.
Oh yeah, did you? Oh yeah, by Alan Coombs. And it started out neat, like the first chapter. I thought, here's a couple things he says about consciousness in the first couple chapters. But this is where I think, in my opinion, he's kind of writing more from himself, trying to understand what is consciousness. And he has these, when I read this, I thought, wow, this is really good. He's saying the same things I say. But let's hear first what he says. I've been interested in consciousness for nearly my whole life, because to me it is the essence of what I am and of what you are and of what it is to be human and what it is to be alive, aware, awake, that what it is like to be me right now and right here, present. For me, it is the very heart, soul, and substance of all that is spiritual, the key to the greatest mystery of all, and the plainest and simplest fact in the world. See, it's interesting how he speaks from himself. Like, he'll say, it's the heart and the soul of... But he doesn't really mean it. Like, he does, but he doesn't, kind of, eh?
Yeah.
But anyway, he goes on, let me put it this way. Consciousness is the background, or simply the ground of all experience. And that I'd totally agree with. And
yeah, that's right.
What Uspensky says.
Yeah.
He says, think of consciousness as a background. It's a background upon which you have all the different contents of experience, all the things you might be aware of. But consciousness is like this background of all experience. And so I totally agree with that. But he never addresses that in the next 200 pages of his book. He only says it in the introduction.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. I was like, and he doesn't really take it anywhere.
And then he goes down, just let me finish this paragraph. Whatever experience you have, whether it is a high mystical rapture, an abysmal depression, an explosive sexual ecstasy, the sight of a bright twinkling star in a dark night sky, the sound of thunder, the taste of honey, or the scent of sandalwood, it all unfolds in an already dimensionless field of perfect emptiness.
Wow.
That is the open, shining ground that lurks behind and permeates all of consciousness.
Wow.
Now, that is what I try to say in my writing.
Yeah,
that's totally consistent with what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That consciousness, like we talk about the Zimzum contraction this idea of how there's this emptiness within the heart. It's like this perfect emptiness.
Yeah.
That we kind of come out of the emptiness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he has that, and he describes this emptiness that is the open, shining ground that lurks behind. So it's like there's this light within emptiness. Like the emptiness is not just empty, but there's this kind of light within it, this shining ground. So that background has kind of light nature that lurks behind and permeates all of experience. It is consciousness. Now, when I read that in the first two chapters of his book, I thought, wow, this is really good.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the book, he completely doesn't come back to any of the profound things he says in those chapters.
Yeah.
And he goes all off into Wilbur's schemes and quadrants and Piaget and different people.
I was really cognitive structures.
And
I was very disappointed
lost.
I was very disappointed by that because I had the same reaction. I was like, and then he starts talking about all this, these schemes and things. I'm thinking, well, what happened to consciousness? You know,
he
started out so well and it went nowhere. It was like, it's a very peculiar book, eh?
Well, it is because it's like he says more when he writes from himself on the first two chapters of his book. Everything there I would thoroughly endorse and say that's totally consistent with what I write in the Heart Doctrine and elsewhere. And then the rest of the book after that, he's off and he's wiseacring.
Yeah.
And he's kind of got all these invented ideas and theory and schemes and terminologies, but he doesn't ever address again that issue of consciousness. And he says consciousness explained better. He never explained anything. It's remarkable. Like, it's typical of what Gurdjieff would call a scientist of new formation. You know, and when they write from themselves, they still, like this author, you know, he begins from himself and he talks about, let's get to the heart and soul of the matter. But then he doesn't really think there's a heart or soul to anything.
Yeah.
You know, but when he waxes metaphorically, he'll speak in what I would say is more objective scientific language.
Yeah.
But then he goes off into all this hundreds of pages of wiseacring that says nothing about the consciousness.
What he's doing, too, is he's basically reporting on what other people have said, and he's not really addressing the issues. I mean, it's interesting because in trying to write the first book I tried to write about, which was based on my own experiences and understanding of the fourth way and how our introduction to it and what it meant and how I came to understand things and also to provide an exposition of the ideas. When I first was writing it, I found that I was trying to essentially repeat what I had read and report it. And then I kind of got bogged down and I knew there was something wrong with what I was doing. And then at one point, after several years, it came to me that it was funny. I was traveling in England and it just sort of struck me when I was on vacation that I was going to go back and I was going to start my book all over again because I was going to try to write it for myself. And so that's what I did when I came back, as I realized I want to write this from my own understanding of things. I'll still provide an exposition of ideas, and you know, they're complicated ideas, and I will quote from books, and I will report on what I've read. But it just seemed to there was sort of a renaissance in terms of my understanding of things, because I realized that before I was just doing it in a rote manner, and now I was trying to be consciously intelligent about it and to try to write it more from my real feelings about things and how I you know, what I'd incorporated and understood, and also to try to really think about what I knew and what I did not know, and to try to recognize the difference, and it made all the difference in the world. So I think there's always that danger in writing about any of these ideas. You know, even if you have a grasp of things, it's hard, eh? But in that particular case, that book just sort of goes off into, as you say, like, the more he goes into his explanation of consciousness, the farther he gets away from consciousness. Whereas at the beginning of the book, like he's describing, like essentially what the Buddhists call the clear light of the void. I think that's, you know, he's right on.
Oh, yeah, by the beautiful. Way, the clear light of the void. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
By the way, the Facts on File Encyclopedia of Word and Phrase Origins says that about Wiseacre, that Wiseacre has lost its original meaning, having once been the Dutch Wiseager. I apologize to anybody who's Dutch. A wise sayer, soothsayer, or prophet, which is apparently an adaptation of the old High German Wiesago, meaning the same. By the time Wiesager passed into English as Wiseacre, excuse me, in the late 16th century, such soothsayers were soothsayers with their know-it-all airs were already regarded as pretentious fools. So originally, Wiseacre did mean somebody who was wise and who was a prophet or somebody who had insight, but then because it became associated with pretentiousness, it became a derogatory term.
Wow, that's very interesting. Yeah. So that's partly what Gurdjieff then saw, or Beelzebub in his book says that going back to the Greek period, that we had the kind of emergence of these bored fishermen. They became scientists and started inventing these sciences, and then we had all these different wiseacres. and these people, he explained, they assume a very significant role in the history of humankind, especially because whenever one had a genuine sacred individual actualized from above, as Beelzebub explains it, who came to the earth and had genuine spiritual teachings, once that person died, all the kind of wiseacres came up and all the people began debating it, and they formed, you know, had different philosophical, religious discussions, and essentially, then Beelzebub says, they would peck it to death.
Yeah.
All the divine teachings, they would peck it to death until you had a veritable mill of nonsense, he would say. And he describes how all the essential religious teachings are stripped of their true meaning by these wiseacres and by the people who kind of collect their religious teachings together. And he also sees them as also intentionally introducing variations into religious teachings to serve their own Husnamussian aims.
Hmm.
For example, he says that the Christian church introduced the ancient idea of heaven and hell in order that their shops could do a better business. And by that, what he means is, like, if if you're a Catholic and you can convince your people that if they don't repent and confess of their sins, they're going to be damned to hell and they're going to boil and all these terrible things. And if they're good and they make donations to their church, well, they'll be rewarded in paradise. And there's an abundance of everything. And all these young women will satisfy their arch-criminal egoistic needs, impulses. And all these fanciful ideas about heaven and hell,
yeah.
Beelzebub regarded as a maleficent fiction invented by Husnamusses to kind of distort what was really said by the divine teachers,
yeah.
Which is not simply that we all have souls and we're guaranteed a place in heaven or hell, but it's a more complex teaching. I mean, Gurdjieff, and another point in his book, says that heaven and hell do exist, but he says not simply out there, but here on earth, like it's within our own spaces in a certain way. But anyway, so that's part of the critique in Beelzebub's tales, is a critique of modern science. And he talks about the Husnamusses who are wiseacres and introduce these distortions and false doctrines which dilute the reasoning capacity of humans, and it also undermines what he calls like the faith, hope, and love, like the belief in the divine sacred being impulses. And it's all interesting because if you look at what science has done over the past century, it's to deprive, to deny the existence of human spirit and soul, and essentially to degrade human beings to being nothing more than simply material organisms or animals which happen by chance to evolve in a godless universe. So, and in science, everything seemed to have one thing followed another mechanically from the origin of the universe to the creation of human beings. It all is thought to have flowed mechanically. It's not believed there were divine beings or spiritual intelligences that play a role in fashioning anything of life. So the past century of modern psychology and science has served to undermine belief in the human spirit and soul or the divine nature of life. And this is all part of what Gurdjieff would call the wiseacring of the sorry scientists or the learned beings.
Yeah, even though, I mean, at the same time, that's the conventional interpretation in terms of the materialist position, in terms of the reductionist methodology, which is sort of reigns supreme in science today, but really, like the history of 20th century physics, much of it, I would say, you know, if you can, you can interpret it a completely different way, and that really the search for the essential building blocks of matter, and the more that physicists have looked at the structure, the architecture of matter, really suggests that we have to deal with the issue of consciousness, and that there's an essential intelligence in the universe. Like, you know, the quote from Sir James Jeans is that in the 30s the preponderance of scientific knowledge was leading to a viewpoint which the more that we studied the universe, the less it resembled a great machine, as in a Newtonian perspective, and the more it looked like a great thought, and the idea that we lived in an intelligent universe. And I mean, I think you could multiply that example by many times in many different fields, but still, for various reasons, this materialist perspective still reigns, and you have people like Dawkins saying, well, science is has disproved the existence of God. But really, that's all just an interpretation in terms of the materialist perspective, and one which I think that, you know, we've consistently argued on this program is really not, doesn't really stand up to careful scrutiny, and can actually be explained in a much more comprehensive and integrated way by including the mystical esoteric perspective, which recognizes the existence of consciousness and an animate and intelligent cosmos, and the idea that the material realm is being informed by these higher dimensions all the time. Like, you know, that we're always in contact with these higher levels. We just don't recognize it.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, when I'm critical of modern science and psychology, in a way, I'm characterizing the mainstream.
Yeah,
that's what I'm doing.
And
in a way, what I'm saying is not accurate. In that, I mean, there are many psychologists who have studied paranormal and psychical phenomena, and there's a considerable dispute within the literature about all of these issues, and you do find scientists who, for instance, elaborate like holographic ideas about consciousness. So there isn't, as you say, there's not this uniformity of thought within hard science itself. It's more the scientists of new formation, that's like the mainstream of materialistic determinist science and psychology with the denial of spirit and soul. And that's the science that's being talked about. And many scientists don't fit that because, you know, especially in the consciousness area, because scientists, you know, they think they know what consciousness is, but everybody knows no one's been able to solve the issue. So there really is a wider diversity of views in modern times. But what seems to totally be neglected in the consciousness literature is, like as I try to outline in the Heart Doctrine book, why don't we consider seriously what the spiritual psychologies of humankind say about the origins of consciousness, that it originates out of the heart? It's not produced by matter, and it's not centered in the head, but there's some higher dimensional process that ensouls the human being through the heart and blood, and that this is a scientific viewpoint. Now, that doesn't mean it's true, but it's a theory, it's a model, it's a hypothesis that's capable of being approached using the scientific method to understand the implications of it, how to try to evaluate it, the applications of such teaching, and so on. So, as we say, at times I tend to characterize psychology and science, like the scientists of new formation. But it is a lot more complex than that, and many people, scientists, don't fit that model, especially some of the most advanced scientists. Hey, Jim, it's people like Heisenberg and Einstein James Jeans. Yeah. It's like the scientists on the cutting edge, David Bohm, scientists like that who they don't accept the simple kind of materialism. They see that that's not complete. But for the most part, the mainstream of science has ignored the issue of human consciousness for a century.
It's so peculiar, though, because, I mean, what you're saying when you represent science and psychology, I mean, really is the predominant viewpoint and establishes the conventional wisdom. I mean, that is the way that people see things, and it's a materialist perspective, and it's based on a denial of soul and spirit, and it's based on this head doctrine and everything that goes with it. And yet, as you just said, you have within the history of modern physics, Ken Wilber has a book, Quantum Questions, in which he talks about how all these major scientists, including all the people we just mentioned, and de Broglie and a few others, like the most prominent physicists of the 20th century, all came to some mystical perspective in some cases, in many cases, or at least a rapprochement with a mystical perspective. And in, like, for instance, Eddington's views is that he said, physics can show us the shadow world, but there's something beyond that, and that really perhaps we have to turn to mysticism, because it's only through mysticism that we can really approach these realities which lie beyond the physical, which are metaphysical. And it's odd that, like, a guy like Carl Sagan, who popularizes science and celebrates the power of science and everything, he never deals with the implications of what these people are saying in his books. He subscribes to this very mechanistic, materialistic perspective on things, and provides all these explanations, which I would say are very Newtonian and don't really. It's almost like the last 100 years of physics hasn't happened, and it's a very peculiar paradox in his presentation, and I would say the same of Dawkins and all these others that argue for the views of this material cosmos in which there's no purpose, no design, and it's just all just dumb non-sentient matter interacting and fulfilling nature's blind mechanical laws. It's like it's such a bleak kind of existential perspective, and yet it's very philosophical and philosophically driven. And then you get, from this perspective, you get somebody like Hawking starting his latest book saying that philosophy is dead, and then going on for 200 pages providing bad philosophy based on his study of physics. It's very peculiar, this disconnect between what science has and hasn't established and how all the meta-theoretical pronouncements that come out of scientists who want to promote this materialist perspective and want to deny spirit and soul and consciousness as anything other than the product of the head brain.
Yeah, and It's like in Hawking's book, he kind of arrives at, oh, the conclusion, like, God is dead now because we don't need him now because now we understand, like, how there are 10 to the power of 500 possible kind of permutations of, and he kind of comes up with this fanciful kind of philosophical issue of, you know, how to explain the improbability of life, and kind of declares, oh, now we don't need God anymore. But yeah. He doesn't present his conclusions as simply a matter of his personal belief. He presents it as though, like, I embody science, and this is what science has proven. There is no God. There is no soul. But that's where the fraud is. Like his argument's interesting. It's an interesting book, and I can understand his argument. But I mean, I think it's completely superficial. But that's the problem. It's presented. It's like Carl Sagan. He believes in real science, and then in his book he says consciousness is manufactured out of matter in the cerebral cortex. Now, someone says that, and they believe in real science. That's not real science. That's the whole thing. Yeah, it's your presumptions. I noticed we're coming down to the end of our show here. That's amazing. We hardly even got too far into Beelzebub, but we'll continue on. It'd be nice to work through the book over the next few radio shows.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here, Jim, today.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Very interesting.
I encourage listeners, go to zeropoint.ca and have a first edition of The Slugs out, which may, hopefully within 3 months, there'll be a new edition, much expanded. But the first edition is very interesting and valuable. And I encourage people to buy The Heart Doctrine and God, Science, and The Secret Doctrine. I have very original contributions to the literature on mystical teachings of modern science. So please visit my website, and you can order my books through Amazon. Thanks, Jim. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yep. Thanks, BBS.
Yep. Thanks, Don, Seth, Doug. Thank you all. Remember yourself. Let's try not to... Yeah, we got three brain beings on planet Earth.
Stop wiseacring.
Yeah. Okay. Goodbye,
okay.
All.
Yeah.
Thanks.